What do you want to do this evening?
Well, what's something that will help with our examination?
Maybe have a little more light so we can see.
Would you like me to read the questions over to you?
Yes, I would. I think that'd be nice.
Seriously?
Then we'd study.
Let's read the book.
That's about, considered a very good method.
Have you got this turned on, Bud?
Is it really a good method?
You have this?
Yes.
Oh, and we don't want to.
It's especially good because the answers will study.
He might read the questions if you turn it off on there.
And then we're supposed to study them.
And then we're supposed to study because you're.
Well, let's have those questions handed down to posterity along with everything else.
Oh, no. Turn it off a second, Bud, will you? Now, I'll give you a sampling of the questions if we don't record it.
Have a big note? She takes shorthand, don't you?
No, we're not.
If I knew, I'd tell them.
It's advantage because we have the smallest group. Our average will be, we don't have the chance on our average at that level.
No, it's fair. The Oklahoma doesn't have too many out and out freshmen any more than your group does.
No, but I'm thinking about the society in Chicago. Think what their norm would be. I'm not thinking of the years in. I'm thinking the number. The number is bound to make your career higher.
I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure. It'll pull them near the middle.
You can grade that on a curve.
Don't they have 165?
No, I don't believe in grading on a curve.
I don't.
You don't?
I think that's a snare and a delusion.
Well, it makes a dumb class look smarter and a smart class look dumb.
I believe in absolute grades.
Well, I've been there for years and I have trouble passing the sophomore.
To grade on. Explain grading on a curve a little bit.
Well, you figure out the normal distribution of your class and you just say that 10% of the class must be excellent and 10% must flunk.
Regardless.
Regardless. And I think that, of course, is for the birds. Because suppose you've got a brilliant class where the class average is 90%. And so you move that over to the middle of your curve and you start splitting in both ways. And suppose you've got a real stupid class where the average is 40%. And you have just as many A's, B's, C's, D's, and flunks in each class.
Well, I'm glad you're not going to do that.
I'm just carrying them out.
Well, that's horrible.
These questions you read off are the type that you'd have to answer them. To make an intelligent answer, you'd have to read the book, and not only read it, you'd have to be interested enough to dig into this.
You'd have to make a point of remembering a lot of things.
No, I don't think exactly remembering as much as understanding.
No, I'll say this. I'm asking nothing in this quiz that I have to look up. If I've got to look it up, I think it's more than a junior quiz.
Yeah.
And believe me, until I remember the seven supreme executives, I was in real trouble on the question of name the seven supreme spirit groups because I could only get six of them, see?
What papers are those supreme executives in?
The seven supreme spirit groups. Paper 17.
There'll be no laundry list or anything like that. Did they use laundry list, Julia, in school?
No, but tell us about it.
Didn't you remember the laundry list to get the answers to your test? On test day, you'd bring in your laundry list and it'd have all the answers. They don't do that anymore?
That's a good idea.
Never heard of that.
Civilization's going backwards.
Sure it is. Sure it is.
That was popular when I was expelled.
You know.
Is it tape recorder?
Yeah.
Oh, good night.
Posterity, yes, that.
You didn't have it all soon enough, though.
Huh?
You didn't have it all soon enough.
I had a woman on here that has a lot more items.
What questions do you want to talk about? We've been working hard today.
I heard a preacher talk for a whole 3/4 of an hour. What was mass? And he didn't tell us.
Man is a splendid and stupid animal. who has the ability to become more than an animal. But usually, if he has his druthers, he'd rather become fat, dumb, and happy.
How about, Bill, we never did that. Well, I guess, no, that wouldn't be a good idea either.
What?
Well, you started talking about government on a neighboring planet, and I think that's a fascinating paper.
You mean to analyze the...
Yeah.
Structure of that government?
Yeah. Started trying to compare them with others.
Well, that's a good point. Structurally, that government has what we have in the sense of having states and the federal government. States are evidently a little smaller than ours because they've got 100 of them. We have exactly 50. And I think many of our states could be subdivided. I think California ought to be two states. Or is that heresy out here? Some of the eastern states are pretty darn populous. And they've got something which we have only imperfectly. We have, how many judicial districts? Is it 12? And we have 12 Federal Reserve districts. In this sense, we partially recognize the need for something between a state and the federal government, or a regional government. In this setup, they distribute their federal government by regions. As I recall, doesn't the president, the chief executive, appoint these regional governors, the heads of the 10 regions containing 10 states each, which distribute the federal government all over that nation. I think their court system is fascinating. They've got labor courts. They've got family courts. They've got, what other kinds? Educational courts. And then they've got standard courts, such as we have, political courts. How the dickens can you settle a labor dispute in front of a typical judge? He doesn't understand economics. He's trained in the law. The kind of judge which would sit in an economic court would have to be part economist, part engineer, and part lawyer. We don't teach such a course in this country. I like the idea that everybody has to go to school before they can run for office. At the present time, any dumb cluck that's a glad-hander can get himself elected. He doesn't have to know anything about his job. And here, before you can even accept nomination, you have to you have to at least have some credentials indicating that you understand administrative procedure. You're trained in political science. They've got a very interesting technique for governing marriage. They make marriage difficult and divorce easy. And they have a more stable situation. The continuation of education appeals to me. William Sheldon, in his Psychology and the Promethean Will, talks about the dying back of the forebrain. And he comments on how most individuals let their intellectual powers go to... They let dry rot set in pretty early. To me, a sheepskin is nothing but a hunting license to go out and get an education. Now that you know how to learn, you should then be like Lao Tse's vessel. You should be full of emptiness so that you can fill yourself.
Well, I don't think the sheepskin indicates that you know how to learn.
That's true, Julia.
I'm sorry to say.
I've had an interesting experience with college trainees in a bank. We've got a pretty good collection of everything from BBAs to bachelors in econ to MBAs from Harvard. These are management trainees. And they're an ignorant bunch of pups. And they think they know everything. And we have a lot of fun. You know the Michigan vocabulary test, Julia?
I've heard of it, but I don't know.
It's one of the dirtiest tests that was ever devised. It's as mean as a senior test would be. We give them this test to prove to them that they don't know very much. And of course, so far, the major reaction has been that the test is no good. There you go.
What's the average vocabulary of the average man today?
I don't know, bud.
In words?
I don't know. But these youngsters, to me, have a good veneer of education. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty darn superficial by this test measurement. On college norms, I would say that the average of this group would be about 40th percentile. And they should run above that because a lot of them are graduates, have graduate degrees.
Well, isn't a graduate supposed to have a vocabulary of 8,000 words or something?
Gee, I don't know.
College, you don't
know.
Is that the fault of the college? It's not new?
I think it's the fault of education.
It's the fault of the people because they haven't demanded better education and pay more for the teachers so they can have better education.
Well, I think education, Julia, has gotten into a cul-de-sac.
It's terrible.
We'll never get better education until we pay for our schools on a head tax basis.
Right.
And that's
the only way. Do they do that in that other world?
What?
Do they do that in this world?
I don't think
so. Well, they talk about tax. They don't have any taxation problems here. It's on 815.
They raise their taxes in a peculiar way.
Importations, mostly.
Royalties, inheritance tax, military.
Control of natural resources.
Protection of?
For one, look at their municipal obligations. They don't need fire department. They got fireproof buildings.
And the fire insurance companies pay for the fire department.
Yeah.
I like the idea of leasing military equipment, making it pay. I don't see how you could lease a gun, but I can see how you could lease a bomber or a battleship.
Who do they lease it to?
People for excursions.
You
know, strength through joy.
Did you ever have a neighbor you needed a bazooka to work them over with?
Here's the thought on education. Suppose you break education down into a number of levels. See what you think of this, Julia. You're up to your eardrums in it. It seems to me that there, on the college level, there are certain disciplines which you can check out pretty well, starting with the physical sciences. The reaction either does or does not take place in the laboratory. There's no doubt about this. This checks out physics. This checks out chemistry. This also pretty well checks out medicine and law. The patient lives or dies. So you can get some estimate of the physician's proficiency. You win or lose your case in court, and this establishes some kind of an objective criterion. These are not as absolutely verifiable as are the physical sciences. And then you move over a little farther, and you get into a very fuzzy realm, starting with economics, sociology, and psychology. These sciences, these arts, want to be definite and precise, and so they introduce as much mathematics into their discipline as a red herring, smokescreen, window dressing. They want to smell like the physical sciences. But the fact that you could have so many schools of psychology, each claiming to have the whole truth and all the truth and nothing but the truth, they're sectarian. You can be Jungian, you can be Freudian, Adlerian, Gestaltist, Watsonian. You don't have these different schools of law because we have a body of common law. And you either know your law or you don't know the law. You don't have these different schools of medicine, at least not such radical departures, because people live or die, and you don't have any difference in the physical sciences. You can get pretty far out on pink cloud 47 in this area because there's no check on what you're doing. And the final category is education itself. it's in the worst spot of all, because it sets its own criteria of success. We graduate people, therefore we are educators, QED.
Bill, the biggest problem with California education is they've taken over the responsibilities of raising children. They teach them to drive, they teach them all the things that the parents normally taught, isn't that right?
Well, and then we've taken over the masses that weren't taught 50 years ago, which has changed the picture.
Sure it has.
Changed the norms and everything.
Masses sure.
That didn't used to go to school at all are now all in school being forced through. It changes the complete picture.
That's right.
But it has taken quite a bit of responsibility away from the parent, which I don't think is at all good.
Well, the parents are the ones that want to give it up.
Well, they both have to work to beat this California economic track, right?
Right.
So they.
But not California, it's nationwide.
Well, especially California. They have to, first one has to work to pay for the gas for the other so he can go to work.
Well, I think in the last analysis, our educational system will improve because of good Russian competition. Well, we aren't ready to go it on our own yet. We still need the competitive urge. We still need to be threatened. You see the whip again. If we're left to our own devices, we make it too easy.
Bill, the most interesting thing about this planet, I think, is their way of dealing with crime, this nation, rather. They finally are doing something that I don't think is going to come about in the world for a long time.
Where is that, Ben?
818. Yes.
Well, they guarantee work and make labor compulsory. You can't loaf. And if you can't find work, you apply and you're given work to do. And if you're antisocial, they just don't let you roam around loose. This is a working group of people.
Any crime against the government is one of the worst crimes there is.
Mm-hmm. It carries a death penalty.
And their efforts to prevent the breeding of criminals and detectives were begun over 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's reversal part of it.
That's correct. What, Benny?
She's surprised to read that there would be war there, but see, this is a continental nation. There are other nations on this planet that are hostile, inferior.
And backwards, inferior.
Very backwards.
This government that they're narrating about is a particular, like, let's say, equivalent to the United States, and there's other nations and continents and so forth.
Geographically, would be more like a more fertile Australia. It's an island continent with only about 25% arid, 3/4 of it pretty fertile.
They've been forced to be isolationists and non-cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
But they, at the end of the paper, they say they started to send out emissaries. Mission to the other nations, and they think they're going to make a mistake. Our author does.
I think they put this paper in here to suggest to us what we might do to clean up our own governmental practices. When you come right down to it, we were pendulumatic when we set up our government. We abolished honors of a hereditary nature. We abolished all honors. So that in the end, we left our citizens nothing to work for but money. And suppose that there were honors for which a citizen could work, something which carried social prestige. You could develop something much more coercive than legal pressure for civic service. You could develop boudoir pressure. Let's imagine a conversation taking place between John and Maggie Tycoon. They're getting dressed for the evening. John is struggling with his studs, and Maggie's sitting at their vanity, combing her hair, and she's talking to John. She says, John, why don't you do something worthwhile? Well, he says, Maggie, $5 million isn't exactly failure. I know, she says, but there's a group out in the country club that I simply can't get into because you don't have a legion of honor from the government. So eventually, because of Maggie's pressure, and that's real pressure, that's much worse than Internal Revenue or the gendarmes or anything else. John can fend those people, but he lives with Maggie. Eventually, John begins to cast about as to how he could go into politics, do a job, and one of John's best qualifications, let's say, to be mayor of Los Angeles is that he's earned $5 million. Number one, he has the ability to do that. And secondly, since he's not hungry, he might not dip into the public till too much. He can afford to be an honest mayor.
We could use one of those.
Sure. Well, how about Chicago? We killed all honors, and I think we made a mistake when we did this, because we didn't leave people things to work for, except money. These people have honors to work for. They can get their franchise extended, which is a good copy of the technique on Jerusalem. Remember on Jerusalem, when you become a citizen, you get one vote. And they examine you periodically. And as you expand in wisdom and so forth, they extend your franchise up to 1,000 votes. So the ignoramuses don't have much chance on Jerusalem, neither do they in this continental nation. What is it? Your votes can go from 1 to 10, isn't it? And you can have as many as 5 super franchises. You have a theoretical limit of 15 votes, but you can never cast more than 10 of them. And these votes are based on educational attainment, social attainment, and taxes which you pay. It seems to me that people who pay a lot of income tax should have a little more to say about what goes on in the treasury than people who don't pay much of any income tax. It's very dismaying to me when I'm in Chicago and go to the polls, and I'm not a very good citizen there because I'm out of town so much, to think that somebody is going to have a vote that counts just as much as my vote, and he may have sold his vote.
I heard an argument along those lines the other day about integration, and this fellow's argument was in trying to prevent the Negro from voting is that he really didn't pay a lot of taxes. He didn't need representation because most of them made very little money and therefore they didn't pay enough taxes. And I said, well, if that's the case, if it's based on money, how come the more you make, the more votes you don't get? He said, well, that's not fair either. So his argument is pretty whole.
Well, I like the suffrage on the neighboring planet.
This what?
They get more votes for service.
Yeah. That's one of their sources of additional votes.
That seems fair.
I know. It is fair. On a neighboring planet, you might sign your name, Julia E. Fenderson, VI. And that would be you're in the 6th level of franchise. And you're hoping to get VII before much longer. It's an honor that you put after your name.
Then we get away with all honors,
huh? When we declared our independence of Britain.
Uh-huh.
Declared our independence of Britain.
What do you mean Britain had honors with their class?
Mm-hmm. Sure, titles.
Well, we've done away with all that and all elementary schools, which I think is a great mistake. All competition is considered very poor. And I think that's a great mistake. Our whole modern philosophy of education now is no competition. That isn't good.
All right. And what was the reaction of this society when I offered you a competitive arena.
Sure.
You took me up. And Oklahoma took me up.
Sure.
And this is a nice way to compete because you're competing as groups, not as people. If you want to be competitive as people, fine. That's optional.
Well, our best way would be to keep our record and then compete against ourselves on the next test.
Let's get some good competition worked up among societies.
Sure.
What's wrong with that?
And then also, Bud could keep us going so our rate would go up all the time.
Sure.
On our
sure.
own.
Sure,
you can come around, we do better.
Compete with your previous record and compete with the best
Are
record.
You're going to be surprised when you see my grade,
I was going to sit by you and talk.
I don't have a big enough laundry that.
Well, Bill, isn't all evolution compensatory?
Yes, I think life is.
Compete to be an evolution.
Yes. The whole history of this planet is nothing but competition.
Right, and life is.
Right now, this country is in competition with Russia. And there's no assurance we're going to win. None whatsoever. The Romans competed unsuccessfully with the barbarians.
And the children do, the minute they get out of school, they're competing in swimming pools and in their games with marbles, with anything they do outside of school, but a teacher cannot put even a star now up, because that is competition and that's frowned upon in all of this educational circles. We're not allowed to put a star or a thing that might make little Johnny feel bad. Because he didn't get a star. And that's the whole philosophy of the United States, and I think it's such a mistake.
Inferiority complex.
Mm-hmm. They're always speaking of the poor little inferior one that might not get the star. And what about the superior ones that are just lolling along and aren't challenged?
That's right.
They're the ones that just get very bad habits.
Well, we're trying to get uniformity, aren't we?
Right. That's our problem.
Mediocrity seeks perpetuation and standardization.
Yeah. That's something. Is that what they call it, the unified school district?
Now listen, I'm speaking for the whole United States.
Well,
this
they're all unified
all.
School districts, but even out here. They all put their garbage out at the same time, and take it in at the same time.
On this, on that other world, feeble-minded are trained only in agriculture and animal husbandry. And they're committed for life to special colleagues.
Would sure help our schools.
Do they disfellowship their feeble-minded?
Sure. Yeah. They take care of them, but they see to it they don't breed.
Something about the
favorite
part of the book. What?
Do I have? Yes. The introduction to paper one. Because the whole story is told there. All of the major themes are expressed in the overture. And I think of it as an overture. It's the thing I always read whenever I have a chance to read something from this book to a group. The first paragraph in the introduction to paper one on page 21 identifies God. And the second paragraph points out that there is a purpose in the universe. There are many worlds that were made to be inhabited by creatures who could know God, receive his affection, and love him in return. This is not an idle experiment. This is a purposeful adventure. And in paragraph 3, they point out what the goal of these creatures is. And then they confront us with the major theme of this book, God's challenge to mortal man. Be you perfect, even as I am perfect. And they point out that we're not left in ignorance as to this challenge. The message is brought home to us. And then in the next paragraph, they point out that this should be real exciting to us. This should give us goose pimples like golf balls. This should get us real jumping. This is it for us. And then they qualify it. They say, now what are we talking about? Does this mean you're going to be equal to God? No. But within your limitations, you can become godlike. You can do, you can become as a creature, perfect, within the limitations of a creature, just as he is perfect, without limitation. And then they repeat again, this is what we mean. This is what God means when he says, when he challenges you, come on, try to be perfect like I am perfect.
How do you try?
Do the best you know.
You try.
What's on that in the exam, Dale?
I wish it could. You try. Mind is your ship. The adjuster is your pilot. The human will is captain. The master of the mortal vessel should have the wisdom to trust the divine pilot, to guide the ascending souls into the Marantia harbors of eternal survival. Only by selfishness, slothfulness, and sinfulness can the will of man reject the guidance of such a loving pilot and eventually wreck the mortal career upon the evil shoals of rejected mercy and on the rocks of embraced sin. With your consent, the faithful pilot will safely carry you across the barriers of time and the handicaps of space to the very source of the divine mind and on beyond, even to the paradise father of adjusters. You try. You try by seeking for spirit identification. You try by, I think, enshrining love in your heart. And love is defined as the desire to do good to others. And if you're unwise, you'll be a do-gooder, than which there is nothing more obnoxious in life. And if you become wise and skillful, you'll become very gracious and graceful in your ministry to your fellow men. And they'll like you. You try by recognizing that material mind is the arena in which human personalities live, are self-conscious, make decisions, choose God or forsake Him, eternalize or destroy themselves.
Betty, that's in that book I read last night, Evolution of the Soul. It's from this page here.
Material evolution has provided you a life machine, your body. The Father Himself has endowed you with the purest spirit reality known in the universe, your thought adjuster. But into your hands, subject to your own decisions, has been given mind. And it is by mind that you live or die. It is within this mind and with this mind that you make those moral decisions which enable you to achieve adjuster likeness, and that is God-likeness. Mortal mind is a temporary intellect system loaned to human beings for use during a material lifetime. And as they use this mind, they are either accepting or rejecting the potential of eternal existence. Mind is about all you have of universe reality that is actually subject to your will. And the soul, the Marantia self, will faithfully portray the harvest of the temporal decisions which the mortal self is making. Human consciousness rests gently upon the electrochemical mechanism below and delicately touches the spirit Marantia energy system above. Of neither of these two systems is the human being ever completely conscious in his mortal life. Therefore, must he work in mind of which he is conscious. You don't know your soul. And you aren't particularly conscious of the fact your heart is beating, or that your digestive and vegetative nervous system is hard at work keeping you alive. You don't know very much about either one of these, but you are conscious. Here you know, here you live. Of neither of these two systems is the human being ever completely conscious in his mortal life. Therefore must he work in mind of which he is conscious. And it is not so much what mind comprehends as what mind desires to comprehend that ensures survival. It is not so much what mind is like as what mind is striving to be like that constitutes spirit identification. It is not so much that man is conscious of God as that man yearns for God that results in universe ascension. What you are today is not so important as what you are becoming day by day and in eternity. Again, this business of motion and direction of motion is all important, and velocity is of no great consequence. Because given enough time, proper direction of motion gets you there at a slow velocity. The only difference between fast and slow motion is time. There is no eternal difference. Mind is the cosmic instrument on which the human will can play the discords of destruction, or upon which this same human will can bring forth the exquisite melodies of God identification and consequent eternal survival. The adjuster bestowed upon man is, in the last analysis, impervious to evil and incapable of sin. But mortal mind can actually be twisted, distorted, and rendered evil and ugly by the sinful machinations of a perverse and self-seeking human will. Likewise, can this mind be made noble, beautiful, true and good, actually great, in accordance with the spirit-illuminated will of a God-knowing human being. Evolutionary mind is only fully stable and dependable when manifesting itself upon the two extremes of cosmic intellectuality, the wholly mechanized and the entirely spiritualized. Between the intellectual extremes of pure mechanical control and true spirit nature, there intervenes that enormous group of evolving and ascending minds whose stability and tranquility are dependent upon personality choice and spirit identification. But man does not passively, slavishly surrender his will to the adjuster. Rather does he actively, positively, and cooperatively choose to follow the adjuster's leading, when and as such leading consciously differs from the desires and impulses of the natural mortal mind. The adjusters manipulate, but never dominate man's mind against his will. To the adjusters, the human will is supreme, and they so regard and respect it, while they strive to achieve the spiritual goals of thought adjustment and character transformation in the almost limitless arena of the evolving human intellect. The material mind of mortal man is the cosmic loom that carries the Maurantia fabrics on which the indwelling thought adjuster threads the spirit patterns of a universe character of enduring values and divine meanings, a surviving soul of ultimate destiny and unending career, a potential finality. The mistakes of mortal mind and the errors of human conduct may markedly delay the evolution of the soul, but they cannot inhibit such a Maurantia phenomena when once it has been initiated by the indwelling adjuster with the consent of the creature will. But at any time prior to mortal death, this same material and human will is empowered to rescind such a choice and to reject survival. Even after survival, the ascending mortal still retains the prerogative of choosing to reject eternal life at any time before fusion with the adjuster. That evolving and ascending creature can choose to forsake the will of the Paradise Father. Fusion with the adjuster signalizes the fact that the ascending mortal has eternally and unreservedly chosen to do the Father's will.
Would you please elaborate a little bit on one part you read, Bill? On 1217. 1217 is the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th paragraph. Because it refers to every one of us so, like now. Only by selfishness, slothfulness, and sinfulness can the will of man reject the guidance.
You don't make decisions. Probably it's more the failure to make a decision, the refusal to accept the challenge. You know what it says in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, the brave music of a distant drum. I'll take the cash and let the credit grow. That's one of the most beautifully pernicious bits of poetry that was ever written. It's simply letting the stream of the challenge of eternity pass you by. It's being too busy.
Selfishness, slothfulness, and sinfulness.
And I think there's more selfishness and slothfulness than sinfulness.
But they are such elastic terms. They cover yes.
That's why I wanted to
yeah.
talk about it. I wanted to
well, if you live a life that's basic, pretty much wholly selfish, then there's no love in your life. And if you don't love, you can't receive love. If you can't receive love, God can't get to you. That's all there is to it. You can't experience His love if you don't give love. If you're slothful, you don't make any decisions. You stand there and they call three strikes on you. You aren't even swinging. You're called out by the umpire. You've demonstrated that you're basically mammalian, not basically human. You're not worthy of survival. If you're sinful, you're in rebellion against God. You're making trouble. You're perverse for some reason or other. And if you have the free will to choose God, then inherent in that freedom must be the range of choice which permits you, in essence, to say to God, I want no part of you.
Well, here comes our limit to free will again, then.
This is the problem. If free will man is endowed with the powers of creativity in the inner man, then must we recognize that free will creativity embraces the potential of free will destructivity. And when creativity is turned to destructivity, you are face to face with the devastation of evil and sin, oppression, war, and destruction. Evil is a partiality of creativity which tends towards disintegration and eventual destruction. All conflict is evil in that it inhibits the creative function of the inner life. It is a species of civil war in the personality. The doing of the will of God is nothing more than the exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with God. With that very God who has made such a creature life of inner meaning value possible. Sharing is godlike, divine. God shares all with the Eternal Son and the Infinite Spirit, while they in turn share all things with the divine sons and spirit daughters of the universes. The imitation of God is the key to perfection. The doing of his will is the secret of survival and of perfection in survival. Mortals live in God, and so God is willed to live in mortals. As men trust themselves to him, so has he, and first, trusted a part of himself to be with men, has consented to live in men, and to indwell men, subject to the human will. Peace in this life, survival in death, perfection in the next life, service in eternity. All these are achieved in spirit now, when the creature personality consents, chooses to subject the creature will to the Father's will. And already has the Father chosen to make a fragment of himself subject to the will of the creature personality. It's a kind of a supernal quid pro quo, you know. Such a creature choice is not a surrender of will. It is a consecration of will, an expansion of will, a glorification of will, a perfecting of will. And such a choosing raises the creature will from the level of temporal significance to that higher estate wherein the personality of the creature son communes with the personality of the Spirit Father. Then it's in that next paragraph where they make that wonderful paraphrase. It is my will that your will be done. Listen, talk about free will. This whole book is jumping with it.
And we should have gotten into the Bible that way. It's pulled by Jesus. Instead of the not my will, but yours
do
not. But
it's
not destructive.
It's free.
It's free. It's also destructive.
Oh, yeah.
I'm still wondering.
So I don't want to take time out, but I'll tell you how.
Did you get it home?
A child learns to love only if its mother has loved it. We know that psychologically. The children don't love, can't love, unless their parents have loved. That child who doesn't know how to love, well, what does that come in his free will then? In number one, selfishness and preventing.
I think there is an innate ability, but it just hasn't been enough practice.
All right. But what about it? Only by selfishness, lovefulness, and sinfulness. And we know psychologically that a baby that hasn't been loved by its mother and father can't give out love and can't love. All right, where does that child come into this picture then? He'll grow up selfish because he's never been trained to be any other way. And he hasn't been loved.
I just don't believe that wholly. I think it is true to 90%, but not wholly. I do think that life gives an opportunity to live out. I know the children are terribly.
You've seen this all through your life with people who haven't been loved and haven't learned how to love.
It's really about this. Human beings possess identity only in the material sense. Such qualities of the self are expressed by the material mind as it functions in the energy system of the intellect. When it is said that man has identity, it is recognized that he is in possession of a mind circuit which has been placed in subordination to the acts and choosing of the will of the human personality. But this is a material and purely temporary manifestation. Just as the human embryo is a transient parasitic stage of human life. Human beings, from a cosmic perspective, are born, live, and die in a relative instant of time. They are not enduring. But mortal personality, through its own choosing, possesses the power of transferring its seat of identity from the passing material intellect system to the higher Maranscious soul system, which in association with the thought adjuster is created as a new vehicle for personality manifestation. And it is this very power of choice, the universe insignia of free will creaturehood, that constitutes man's greatest opportunity and his supreme cosmic responsibility. Upon the integrity of the human volition depends the eternal destiny of the future finality. Upon the sincerity of the mortal free will, the divine adjuster depends for eternal personality. Upon the faithfulness of mortal choice, the universal father depends for the realization of a new ascending son. Upon the steadfastness and wisdom of decision actions, the supreme being depends for the actuality of experiential evolution.
What is this sincerity of the free will? Why is that to qualify?
Without sincerity, you're nothing. You're phony.
I understand that, but how can this be sincerity be applied to free will?
Oh, you're making sincere choices, even though they may be mistaken. If they're sincere decisions, they're good. Because if the results of them are bad, you'll learn. And if you're sincere, you're open-minded, you're teachable. If you're insincere, the whole thing is a fraud. And then they put in a word of kindness. Though the cosmic circles of personality growth must eventually be attained, and here's what you were talking about, Julia, if through no fault of your own, the accidents of time and the handicaps of material existence prevent your mastering these levels on your native planet, if your intentions and desires are of survival value, there are issued the decrees of probation extension. You will be afforded additional time in which to prove yourself. In other words, you are going to get a square shake. The accidents of time are not going to be held against you. If there ever is doubt as to the advisability of advancing a human identity to the mansion worlds, the universe governments invariably rule in the personal interests of that individual. They unhesitatingly advance such a soul to the status of a transitional being, while they continue their observations of the emerging Marantia intent and spiritual purpose. Thus, divine justice is certain of achievement, and divine mercy is accorded a further opportunity for extending its ministry. The governments of Orvantan and Nebadan do not claim absolute perfection for the detailed working of the universal plan of mortal repersonalization, but they do claim to, and actually do manifest patience, tolerance, understanding, and merciful sympathy. We had rather assume the risk of a system rebellion than to court the hazard of depriving one struggling mortal from any evolutionary world of the eternal joy of pursuing the endless career. Let me read you this again from a different standpoint. To the extent that we do the will of God, in whatever universe station we may have our existence, in that measure, the almighty potential of the Supreme becomes one step more actual. If all grand universes should ever relatively achieve the full living of the will of God, then would the time-space creations be settled in light and life. When an evolving mind becomes attuned to the circuits of cosmic mind, when an evolving universe becomes stabilized after the pattern of the central universe, when an advancing spirit contacts the united ministry of the master spirits, when an ascending mortal personality finally attunes to the divine leading of the indwelling adjuster, then has the actuality of the supreme become real by one more degree in the universes. Then has the divinity of supremacy advanced one more step toward cosmic realization. The parts and individuals of the grand universe evolve as a reflection of the total evolution of the supreme, while in turn, the supreme is the synthetic cumulative total of all grand universe evolution. From the mortal viewpoint, both are evolutionary and experiential reciprocals interacting.
Will you eventually, in the course of expound on moral attunement, evolving mind, advancing spirit? I am curious to follow the pattern of ascendancy.
Say those again. Moral attunement?
Moral attunement, mortal attunement, evolving mind, advancing spirit. It mentions them. I'd like to know.
Mortal attunement, I think, to me would mean living in harmony with the grain of the universe, with the will of God. Advancing mind, to me, would mean
evolving mind
would mean the evolution of mind as it takes place down here, as the child mind grows into the adult mind, and as the adult mind may achieve the levels of maturity, and then on beyond to the higher levels of mind. The advancing spirit of man means, to me, the growing spiritualization of the evolving soul, to some extent the spiritualization of mind in this life, to a far greater extent the spiritualization of the Marantia soul in the next life. This is progress, this is growth. As we emerge from matter towards spirit, we become more real as people. This is a business of going from the pupil stage to the larval stage to the adult form. We have to hatch out. We're really in the egg form down here. The Marantia existence is the larval form. And then someday, we emerge as a butterfly from a caterpillar. That's the spirit form. The supreme is God in time. His is the secret of creature growth in time. His also is the conquest of the incomplete present and the consummation of the perfecting future. And the final fruits of all finite growth are power, control through mind, by spirit, by virtue of the unifying and creative presence of personality. The culminating consequence of all this growth is the Supreme Being. To mortal man, existence is equivalent to growth. The cosmic reality, variously designated as the Supreme Being, God the Supreme, and the Almighty Supreme, is the complex and universal synthesis of the emerging phases of all finite realities. The far-flung diversification of eternal energy, divine spirit, and universal mind, attains finite culmination in the evolution of the Supreme, who is the sum total of all finite growth, self-realized on deity levels of finite maximum completion. The Supreme is the divine channel through which flows the creative infinity of the deities that crystallizes into the galactic panorama of space, against which takes place the magnificent personality drama of time, the spirit conquest of energy matter through the mediation of mind. There's that theme that goes all through here. Said Jesus, I am the living way. And so he is the living way. From the material level of self-consciousness to the spiritual level of God-consciousness. And even as he is this living way of ascension from the self to God, so is the Supreme the living way from finite consciousness to transcendence of consciousness, even to the insight of absonity. Mortal man is more than figuratively made in the image of God. From a physical standpoint, this statement is hardly true. But with reference to certain universe potentialities, it is an actual fact. In the human race, something of the same drama of evolutionary attainment is being unfolded. This takes place on a vastly larger scale in the universe of universes. Man, a volitional personality, becomes creative in liaison with an adjuster, an impersonal entity, in the presence of the finite potentialities of the Supreme, and the result is the flowering of an immortal soul. In the universes, the creator personalities of time and space function in liaison with the impersonal spirit of the Paradise Trinity, and thereby become creative of a new power potential of deity reality. Mortal man, being a creature, is not exactly like the Supreme Being, who is deity. But man's evolution does in some ways resemble the growth of the Supreme. Man consciously grows from the material toward the spiritual by the strength, power, and persistency of his own decisions. He also grows as his thought adjuster develops new techniques for reaching down from the spiritual to the morontial soul levels. And once the soul comes into being, it begins to grow in and of itself. This is something like the way in which the Supreme Being expands. His sovereignty grows in and out of the acts and achievements of the Supreme Creator personalities. That is the evolution of the majesty of his power as the ruler of the grand universe. His deity nature is likewise dependent on the pre-existent unity of the Paradise Trinity. But there is still another aspect to the evolution of God the Supreme. He is not only creator evolved and Trinity derived, he is also self-evolved and self-derived. God the Supreme is himself a volitional, creative participant in his own deity actualization. The human morontial soul is likewise a volitional, co-creative partner in its own immortalization.
What does this imply once the soul comes into being?
The soul buys a stack of chips and starts playing the game within the limits of its ability. The soul is not just passive. The Supreme Being did not create man, but man was literally created out of, his very life was derived from, the potentiality of the Supreme. Nor does he evolve man, yet the Supreme himself is the very essence of evolution. From the finite standpoint, we actually live, move, and have our being within the immanence of the Supreme. As we view the ceaseless struggles of the creature creation for perfection of status and divinity of being, we cannot but believe that these unending efforts bespeak the unceasing struggle of the Supreme for divine self-realization. God the Supreme is the finite deity, and he must cope with the problems of the finite in the total sense of that word. Our struggles with the vicissitudes of time and the evolutions of space are reflections of his efforts to achieve reality of self and completion of sovereignty within the sphere of action which his evolving nature is expanding to the outermost limits of possibility.
Could not it have been phrased better? There are several spots in here where it says God is no respecter of man.
Person.
Of persons.
Of person. Or persons.
That's
could
from the Bible.
Could not this have been worded?
They're paraphrasing the Bible there.
They're quoting exactly, word for word, mm-hmm. from the Bible, are they not?
Yes. It might have been phrased more happily, but it could not have been phrased more traditionally. Throughout the grand universe, the Supreme struggles for expression. His divine evolution is in measure predicated on the wisdom action of every personality in existence. When a human being chooses eternal survival, he is co-creating destiny. And in the life of this ascending mortal, the finite God finds an increased measure of personality self-realization and an enlargement of experiential sovereignty. Mankind does not ascend effortlessly in the universe. Neither does the Supreme Being evolve without purposeful and intelligent action. Creatures do not attain perfection by mere passivity, nor can the spirit of supremacy factualize the power of the Almighty without unceasing service ministry to the finite creation. The Great Supreme is the cosmic oversoul of the grand universe. In him, the qualities and quantities of the cosmos do find their deity reflection. His deity nature is the mosaic composite of the total vastness of all creature, creator nature throughout the evolving universes. In the eternal future, God the Supreme will be actualized, creatively expressed and spiritually portrayed in the spiritualized mind, the immortal soul of ascendant man, even as the universal Father was so revealed in the earth life of Jesus. Man does not unite with the Supreme and submerge his personal identity. But the universe repercussions of the experience of all men do thus form a part of the divine experiencing of the Supreme. The act is ours, the consequences God's. We seek.
Excuse me, this is the act is ours, the consequences God's.
Yes. We keep the character accruals of all our actions, good or bad. The consequences of these actions reverberate and repercuss in the Supreme Being, good or bad.
Remember that one, life is all but a day's work. Do it well, the answers are consequences.
Yes, yes, but I've never quite understood it.
Well, the all action, all significant action above the level of trivia repercusses in two ways: inwardly upon the one who acts and outwardly upon his environment. And the ultimate repository of the outward repercussion is the Supreme Being, if the act has significance. We seek the Supreme in the universes, but we find him not. quote, "He is the within and the without of all things and beings, moving and quiescent, unrecognizable in his mystery, though distant, yet is he near," unquote. That's from the Tao Te Ching. "The Almighty Supreme is the form of the yet unformed, the pattern of the yet uncreated," again from the Tao Te Ching. "The Supreme is your universe home, and when you find him, it will be like returning home. He is your experiential parent, and even as in the experience of human beings, so has he grown in the experience of divine parenthood. He knows you because he is creature-like as well as creator-like. If you truly desire to find God, you cannot help having born in your minds the consciousness of the Supreme. As God is your divine father, so is the Supreme your divine mother, in whom you are nurtured throughout your lives as universe creatures." Again, a quote from the Tao Te Ching. "How universal is the Supreme. He is on all sides. The limitless things of creation depend on his presence for life, and none are refused." What Michael is to Nebadon, the Supreme is to the finite cosmos. His deity is the great avenue through which the love of the Father flows outward to all creation. And he is the great avenue through which finite creatures pass inward in their quest of the Father who is love. Even thought adjusters are related to him. In original nature and divinity, they are like the Father. But when they experience the transactions of time and the universes of space, they become like the Supreme. The act of the creature's choosing to do the will of the Creator is a cosmic value and has a universe meaning, which is immediately reacted to by some unrevealed but ubiquitous force of coordination, probably the functioning of the ever-enlarging action of the Supreme Being. The Maranscha soul of an evolving mortal is really the son of the adjuster action of the Universal Father, and the child of the cosmic reaction of the Supreme Being, the Universal Mother. The mother influence dominates the human personality throughout the local universe childhood of the growing soul. The influence of the deity parents becomes more equal after the adjuster fusion and during the super universe career. But when the creatures of time begin the traversal of the central universe of eternity, the father nature becomes increasingly manifest, attaining its height of finite manifestation upon the recognition of the universal father and the admission into the core of the finality. All soul-evolving humans are literally the evolutionary sons of God the Father and God the Mother, the Supreme Being. Men too often forget that God is the greatest experience in human existence. Other experiences are limited in their nature and content, but the experience of God has no limits, save those of the creature's comprehension capacity. And this very experience is in itself capacity enlarging.